Welcome back to the Open Source Startup Podcast. I'm Robbie from Cowboy Ventures, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Tim Chen from Essence VC. And today, we are super excited to have the co-founder and CEO of Armo on the podcast, Shauli Rosen. And this is the company behind Kubescape, which is the leading Kubernetes security vendor out there. Shauli is based in Israel and joining us very late his time, but we're super excited to have him on the podcast. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. As an Israeli founder, hate to say you are not my last meeting for the day.
Awesome. So why don't we go all the way back to the beginning and learn about where the idea for Kubescape initially came from and how it turned into Armo?
Yeah. We started out with, Kubernetes was becoming very popular, and a bunch of security experts, not me, by the way, my co-founders are the security expert, like they're the tech brains, said, this Kubernetes thing is bringing new complexity into environment, new complexity into security, and we kind of like need to solve that. And we started speaking like security guys. So we speak with CISOs and we reach out to security officers. And, it was like, one after the other, like the same response, which is, let me get my DevOps team involved. These guys, they manage Kubernetes. And as we got more and more involved, we kind of like realized this big shift that is happening where, Kubernetes security is very much, or at least a huge part of it, is in the hands of the DevOps and the DevSecOps or platform engineers or OSRE, or, today there are so many different titles. And I think that was where, and it was like 2021, where we thought, okay, let's leave the CISOs aside. If they bring us to the DevOps, let's go directly to the DevOps. What can we do that will benefit the DevOps? And once you go to that state of mind, that's where things like, okay, you need to self-onboard, you need to be open source, you need to be developer friendly came about. And that was actually when we decided to release an open source project called Kubescape. And we released it at the beginning as a configuration scanning tool. And it took off really, really quickly. I think like in the first month, we got to like 1,000 stars. I remember people calling me, are you buying stars? What are you doing? And I said, no, we're not buying stars, just happening. And, it was a real excitement. And we built on top of that. And since then, from a scanning tool, Kubescape is today maybe one of the most comprehensive, open source Kubernetes security platforms, covering a lot of things from CI/CD to production, from configuration scanning to role-based access control scanning to runtime things that we do to vulnerability scanning, and a lot of good and exciting stuff that we're bringing on. And, we recently contributed Kubescape to the CNCF as a sandbox project in order to make it more ubiquitous. And yeah, we have a very big, vision of becoming, the standard open source security platform out there. We believe open source is the way to go when it goes to Kubernetes security, and definitely and mostly because the users are DevOps users, developer users who would like that openness and would like to contribute, and we get a lot of contributions and feedback, and that's great.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. And I'm very curious about Armo, the company, but I think we'll probably start with the Kubescape project first. You mentioned you get 1,000 stars off the gate. That's not easy at all. Obviously, I think this is back in 2020, right? And where Kubernetes are already pretty really popular, getting a lot of love. But I'm just curious, how did you position it? You said it's a scanning tool for configurations, but I believe there are other configuration scanning tools already. How are you able to actually be popular right off the gates?
Well, I think to be very honest, it was about solving a very quick and easy problem. I know you read we had this notion of like getting your results in 3 minutes. I think it worked very well, and we actually delivered on that promise. So we were a very small tool then, right? And we've solved a very specific problem of checking your cluster against the NSA standard. Until this day, one of the biggest values is like, yeah, how do I stand against the different standards, CIS, and we have many more these days. But back in the days, it was about NSA, and the NSA guidance for Kubernetes hardening was launched, just before we launched Kubescape. And the timing, I think, was very good, as well as the value that we provided very quickly. We had comments like, wow, this is pure gold. My security team was asking me how I stand against the NSA. I just ran this. And I think that went viral very, very quickly. And I think that was the driver. So I think it was timing, while also providing very specific and very clear value very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, because I actually noticed there are quite a few security companies started just as an open source project, validating against the standard and getting more popular and widespread. But I think one common question I do see, though, from this sort of origin is it's not always so obvious where to go from there, you know, because there's so many different paths you can take, especially when it goes to security. There's all kinds of things. And actually, when I saw your announcement for your seed round back in 2021, it wasn't really just around scanning configurations at all. Actually, Qscape wasn't even just around that component. So I'm very curious, how do you go from configuration scanning, doing something simple, to RMO about the product that you have, right? At that C stage, what was the exploration process look like for you? How did you get to, did you try different things, or do you have a certain like conviction in a particular area, and did it work out or not? I'm just very curious about that process.
Yeah, that's an amazing question. Yeah. So when we started, we actually thought that, you know, runtime security and providing, you know, process control, network policies, you know, that's the thing. You know, we guys, we're security guys, right? So we are very much about like real security, let's prevent stuff, let's find the attackers, etc. But then when we released Qscape, it was a step back into the pipeline, into configuration. And I think one of the brave things we did was not to stick to our thought and our thoughts. And what happened, I don't know, I don't want to say it's easy. It sounds easy, you know, if you look at it at retrospective, but when you have so many users and they start speaking with you and commenting on GitHub, and you open a Discord and you get like 500 people on Discord commenting on what you're doing, they actually tell you what they want, right? So we actually, you know, followed the, I don't want to say advice, but the needs that we heard from the people that we spoke with. And I think that's, you know, the main challenge for every startup. You know, rarely do you begin with whatever will crack the market, right? You start with something, you listen to your users, in our case, it's not customers, and we just build on top of that. And, you know, new frameworks came because of that. Image scanning came because of that. A role-based access control was something that so many people were saying how difficult it is for them to understand what's going on in the clusters, in the different roles. And we just built on top of that. And I think the vision of becoming a platform just matured out of that. So at the beginning, it was following requirements and following, you know, users who were telling us what they wanted, what they were thinking. And I think the vision of the platform came out of that. It wasn't like we were thinking about the platform all the way. Like, it was really built from the ground up.
Awesome. And you touched on a lot of things in there on how powerful open source can be. I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier about how important it was to make Qscape developer friendly. And obviously open source is a big part of that. But what other parts of the project did you make sure were like key components to make it truly like developer friendly and developer centric?
Yeah. So first of all, the notion of a developer ability to take the project, take the product, run it on his own without like, you know, like a developer will rarely click on a, you know, book a demo. Now, that's not the idea. They're not looking to someone to guide them. It really needs to be quick to install, non-intrusive. Was very critical. You know, we're running outside of your cluster, just via API, provide value quickly and explain what the value that you're going to bring early on. So basically, if you ask me, you know, a developer goes or a DevOps person goes on to the or GitHub, he sees like the screenshot of what the results are going to look like. He sees a curl of what he's going to run. He understands, he runs it. And I think that's the key component. By the way, like, I don't think it has to be open source. I believe in open source, and I think that's the way to go. But the same thing can be done without open source. I think the value of the open source is, first of all, you get contributions. And then also, maybe just a matter of, you know, the psychology of it, but an open source project creates a lot of society around it. So you get much more participation and much more feedback. And I think that really, really helps us to grow and create a product that the users love.
And I noticed you're also a CNCF sandbox project. So maybe talk about some of the motivations, even going for CNCF at all. Because I think a lot of Kubernetes, more infrastructure-related companies or, you know, runtimes or things that developers or, you know, people that build upon typically goes to CNCF that I notice. But as a scanning tool, maybe talk about what is the motivations doing going there.
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing, and it's not really about motivation, but it was really about analysis of the CNCF landscape and whether there is a security platform in there. And there wasn't. There was no security platform. There were a lot of different tools or different things that you can use, some of them not in the CNCF, but our projects. And we felt that it is something that is missing. And then we started to research. We actually searched for the motivation. So, you know, we had a lot of questions about, you know, my board was asking, why are you thinking about contributing to CNCF? Like, what are you getting out of it, right? Like, you're just contributing. So I think there are several things that we are hoping to get out of CNCF, and we feel like it's going to benefit the open source project. One is recognition. There are many companies, big companies, that look at the CNCF as a standard or as a way to build confidence in the development practices and the open source practices that the project applies. And we really wanted to get that, confidence, and we want them to be able to trust us and trust the project and actually use the product and the project. So that's the first motivation. And the second motivation is to get contributors to join our project. We had about 100 different contributors contributing to the project when we started, like before we contributed to CNCF. Now we have around 140. And we are seeing more and more what I would call quality contributions. People who have been around the open source area, and their contributions, to be very honest, are much, much more valuable. And their people like people from Gitpod and people like who've been around are super valuable to have in the community. They help us with the roadmap, help us with thinking. And I think that's the second part of the motivation.
That makes a ton of sense. And you talked about one of the benefits of having such a big and vibrant community is you can use that to drive your product roadmap. But at the same time, that can become super noisy. I think you said you very quickly had 500 users on Discord. I'm sure now it's so many more. How do you figure out, because that's like such a powerful signal of where to take the project, but I'm sure depending on the user and their use case and the size company they're at and the industry, all these things, they'll have different views on where you should take the project and product. So how do you actually sift through that and get the right signal and kind of know where to focus?
Yeah. So first of all, it's not easy and you make mistakes. You know, sometimes you follow the noise. You know, someone might be just more vocal than others in the requirements, and then you go there. And we've sometimes made those mistakes. But in general, what you want to try to apply is, you know, filter the noise based on like what we try to create. And honestly, we don't always succeed in that, is to actually digest all of that information and put it in a more analytical way. So how many people are telling us this, and how many people are telling us that, and you know, how hard it is to build this. And if you do that, what's the next thing that they're going to ask you? And we had these weekly meetings and roadmap meetings where we reviewed user feedback. And that's kind of like the way we managed it. Now, eventually, I have to say, you're completely right. Discord became so noisy, we closed it. We closed Discord and we moved to a CNCF channel, like a Slack channel for CubeScape in the CNCF. And the level of conversation there is much, much deeper. And we see that really, you know, creating better conversations. So, you know, it's tricky. I wouldn't say that there is a rule of thumb on how to do that. But in general, you know, our product team was in charge of like looking at everything and kind of like, I would say, curating what we are hearing in the different channels.
So I'm actually curious, because you mentioned that you started with CubeScape and then you actually tried runtime security and then kind of listened to your users. But when I saw your seed round announcement, it was actually talking about a runtime, I think, application embedded security component when you raised your seed round, actually. So yes. I wonder, when did you start to listen to the signals? Was this actually even after the seed round? You know, after you, because in announcement post, you talked about you're already working with several design partners. So I guess it wasn't like a quick switch. It sounded like you actually raised your seed round first with the intention to actually build a lot of runtime security. And at some point between the A and the C, there's something that happened. Actually, I'm very curious, like, if it's like a quick thought, just a quick prototype, right? You know, you can just throw it away. But if you raise around with that intention and you're already working on it, that's really hard to switch. And I've noticed a lot of founders really hard to make that judgment call of, am I just too early, right? Is the other side actually, there's anything there or not, right? We have a lot of doubts, actually. What is the level of conviction or unconviction that you had to take to change this around to not what you're doing now?
So just in terms of timelines, you are right. It like we did runtime before we did open source and scanning. It's not that we thought about doing runtime. We already did runtime. And our seed round, as you say, was raised on the promise of runtime security. And we took that to CISOs. And if you remember, I started the podcast by saying, when we went to those CISOs, they brought us the DevOps. And then there was a point in 2021. And you know, I'll give you a tip here for all of those founders. You can sell everything 2, 3, 5 times. Everything. You can sell runtime security. You can sell embedded software. You can sell anything can be sold 5 times. You know, you're tenacious enough. You know, you're convincing enough. You will sell. And we did sell. But the feedback that we got from the market and what we realized is that CISOs are sending us to the DevOps. So we took a step back and we said, okay, what's interesting for DevOps? And that's when we completely changed the view of the company. And we went into, so think about DevOps. They don't want intrusiveness. They don't want, you know, what you just said, like that software running within their environment, protecting from within. They want something simple. They want something quick. They want something open source. We took all of that and we say, okay, let's try that. And once we saw that and that it worked, you know, that's when we doubled down on it and we completely changed the company to fit DevOps needs. And as you said, it's not an easy thing. You know, many people within the company, we were all uncertain. You know, it's a move that you take and it can work and it cannot work. But once we saw, and we were a little bit lucky that it succeeded so quickly, because it gave us confidence. You know, if you ask me where we would be if we started and, you know, we would not get feedback and it would kind of like slowly go forward, it would have been much, much harder to kind of like double down and make that choice. So I think we were somewhat lucky in that sense. But now we have so much, you know, we have such a great product. We have such a great understanding of our users. And also we have that technology. We still have that technology waiting for the time that Kubernetes will be ready for it. But yeah, I think it's, like you said, it's a very, very hard move to take, but you need to take it. And we had customers that we stopped serving on that product.
It's super interesting because it wasn't like a complete pivot. It was just a repositioning, new user persona, what you were trying to build. I'm wondering what was the, and maybe it was some of the customers that you had to in some way like shut down and stop serving the same way. Like what were some of the hardest parts of doing that, or like the things you had to get over mentally, or like the hardest conversations, whether it was folks on your team, investors, because I think a lot of founders, to Tim's point, like they struggle with doing this because you're kind of down a path. And then like, especially once you raise money, like you're kind of like locked and loaded. And so you want to make a change if it's the right decision, but there are a lot of doubts and questions that will come up from yourself, but then also like all the people involved with your original direction.
So, you know, it's a deep question, first of all, right? And I would say the first element of that is the sunk cost. And sunk cost is like, even if you think about investors, many times investors throw good money after bad money because of sunk cost. And the same thing happens to you emotionally when you are doing, we invested so much time and effort in a certain direction. So I think that's one part of it. And the second part of it, if I'm trying to be like a 2-cent psychiatrist for a minute, is that you need to admit that you were wrong or that the path that you took was not the best path. And that, you know, takes a deep look at yourself as a person, but also at your team. And you all need to be kind of like bold enough to say that. And I think I had like good support, both from my team and from my, you know, board and from the market that really helped us to do that. We were lucky not to have a problem. Some companies might have a problem when they make such a choice of not having the right capabilities within the company to go into that direction. You know, like, do I have the right team? Do I have the right people to do that? Luckily, we had the right team. We had people who like were thinking, drinking open source, you know, because they were developers on their own. Like, we are a team of engineers. So it was, you know, we had the competency to do that. But sometimes that could be also a barrier.
It's super tough for most founders to do that. And I think one is actually listening to the markets, because you can listen one thing and have 2, 3, 5 different interpretations of what it means, right? And I think every founder definitely goes a different path. So I want to go down deeper into the platform, the product, because I think, like I said, you mentioned you start with a DevOps angle, right? You want them to be happy. You want them to actually have, not just do it for security, sounds like, right? You know, I'm not here just able to do something that I don't care about. So the misconfiguration is definitely a starting point. But looking at your product today, it definitely seems like it's actually expanded towards a lot more security minds. You talk about CSPMs now in your blog post. You're talking about like a bunch of like security-minded features that the security teams will care about. But also you have the VS Code extensions, where you have things that the DevOps people want to use even earlier. So it seems like you're expanding both sides. One is on the development cycle, CI/CD integrations. One is like a more deeper security. I'm very curious, like how did you sort of balance? Because if you go too much security features or you go too wide or just getting a lot more shift left, I guess some of your workflow, it might be hard to do all things right. I wonder, is there sort of thought process or experimentation here for you to say, which, let's get the DevOps fully happy end to end before we go on it, or just more of like a let's take one layer of a cake at a time approach?
Yeah. So that's a question I live with every day, right? And I have a very, you know, I hope well-rounded thinking about that. And it starts with what I think is a huge misconception that DevOps don't care about security. So DevOps do care about security. Security capabilities are getting more and more into DevOps from, you know, DevSecOps, cloud engineers, security engineers are becoming part of the DevOps team, or I would say the platform team. And I want to delight those people, like DevOps, DevSecOps, and that's like 90% of, you know, the effort that we are making. And it is very, very clear. When I'm talking about CSPM, okay, I'm talking about, in my mind, my thoughts around CSPM is why we are different than CSPM. CSPM, they go to the CISO, they go to the security team, like the analysts, and they are all about coverage, and they are all about the ecosystem of the cloud, the different cloud services and the different cloud configurations. We are all about Kubernetes and the Kubernetes ecosystem. So we are about Helm and Argo CD and Kubernetes itself. And I completely see a way for us to co-live with a CSPM vendor in the same organization when they serve the security, like executive team, let's say, or risk analysis team, and we serve the DevOps because they need something which is much more practical that will give them remediation in their environment, in what they're currently doing. And we see that happening in several accounts. So the way I look at it, like I don't get confused by trying to serve the CISO, but on the other hand, I'm not completely disregarding the CISO. You know, we have the right dashboards and the right reports for them to have. But the way I look at it, I don't see a CISO logging in to our system. I see our DevOps telling the CISO, yeah, we got that covered. Here's a report. Here's a SOC 2 report. Here's a CIS report. Here's what you need. So that's kind of like the way I look at it. And so that's the right side, and why not going up into CSPM? Then the left side is something which we are leaning more towards, but still not all the way. Okay. Because again, there is a difference between developer and DevOps. And we want to focus on the DevOps and the platform engineering team. So yeah, we do have a VS Code extension, but the idea in the VS Code extension and the different extension that we do for developers is for the DevOps to be able to equip the developers with things early on in order for things not to get into their environment and for them to control that process. I hope it's coherent, but that's my state of mind.
So we've talked a lot about the KubeScape and open source shift that you took. I wonder if there are other moments or other big decisions after that that you think were super pivotal for like getting where you are today. Because it sounds like you released KubeScape, 1,000 stars, lots of users. Like, has it just been a pretty linear growth trajectory from there? Or have there been a couple other like major product decisions or like marketing or anything that have really kind of been super pivotal in like the trajectory you're on now?
Well, by far, the choice to create KubeScape was the biggest tipping point for the company so far. But after that, I think there have been a couple of, you know, big decisions that we needed to make. One is to really double down on open source. So not to leave it as a tool and too quickly build a closed source on top of that, but to have the patience and to have the tenacity to actually create a big enough tool and keep it open source. And this is something that whenever you run an open source company, constantly you get those tensions of, yeah, why are we giving this for free? Why are we giving this for free? You know, why don't we make that closed source? And to hold that and to, you know, be strong enough to maintain this open source, I would say, a strategy and way of thinking is not always easy. That was, the second part. And then the third part was when we understood that we do need to sell, right? And we do need a platform that makes us money. And so I think the second part was to identify the right point to bring in a sales team and a business team and actually starting to monetize and not be shy and not be concerned by telling people, yeah, we have a paid version. And after a certain level, you have to pay. And that point, when you have a free product and you need to start asking people to pay, is a scary point. It's a scary point in time where we're thinking, wait, what will happen if I ask them to pay and no one pays? Maybe they're only using it because it's free. And like you have all of those concerns. So my recommendation there is the minute you feel like you have something valuable enough, don't wait. Because the reality is, even if they don't pay, you want to know about it early. Luckily, you know, things are working, but I think that's a point. It's a decision to say, okay, we are starting to ask for money. It's a second, I would say inflection point in building the company.
Yeah, so I'd like to maybe ask more about your cloud platform. And What's interesting, when I signed up right away, and I realized—
Another user.
happy user already. Oh, well, just tried it for 5 minutes. So I think one thing I noticed, not many Series A companies, especially in security, already do this, which you upfront ask, how big is the company? What is your primary use case? Right? And then you run into install step. And I'm just very curious, what is your cloud platform? What does it do? How did you go to a separation between your open source and managed products? I'm just always curious, like, what was the intention to try to capture audience so quickly? Do you customize experience for them? Or do you have a certain type of different sort of way to engage them? Or just like a different settings? I'm just very curious, like, how did you treat that product onboarding as well?
So first, I have to say that your experience is from the last 2 to 3 weeks. Like, we didn't have that until the last 3 weeks. We decided to add that. So first, take a step back. What does the platform do? Basically, you know, it takes KubeScape, which is an open source, and it gives a control plane, a management plane on top of that. And by the way, we are also planning to increase more and more the management plane of Kubernetes as an open source. But for now, most of it is in the managed platform. So when you sign up to the managed platform, you get all of your clusters, all of your CI/CD, all of that information into one place. And also we are running algorithms for prioritization, because one of the things that I believe are the most problematic things in security system today are, you know, okay, you give me all of that noise or all of that information, and what do I do with it? So we are really taking a lot of efforts into minimizing and developing more tools that will minimize the noise in the system. You know, one of the things that we are coming out with, I think next month, we already have it running, but officially, is a relevancy project where we are running eBPF in your environment. We see exactly what is running in the environment, and we deprioritize vulnerabilities if they are in packages that never go to memory. And you know, that's where, you remember we talked about our capabilities from runtime that we stopped doing, but that's where it comes to play. And I think that's a smart way to take it into play, because you don't take it into enforcement, you take it back to the CI/CD and you take it back into value for your users. So those are the things that we are building, and we're trying to show you only things that can be fixed, remediated, etc. Now, why are we asking whether you're a security person or, you know, or a DevOps person and the size of the company? We do optimize for that. We see that security people are usually more about reports. DevOps people are more about remediation. So we will actually, it's not that we are having a different product for each one of them, and we're not an e-commerce company that will kind of like show you different product if you're a male or a female. We're not at that level yet. But we do give you a little bit of a different experience, mainly through our onboarding and mainly through our intercom and the messages and the guidance that we will actually help you through the product.
That's very smart. And we talk to a lot of founders on here that will have multiple personas they serve. But at this stage, I think it's really savvy to have a different onboarding, like content, everything experience for them. I'm wondering now that you have, so you talked about figuring out the right time to focus on a commercial product being like a really important moment in an open source company's journey. Now that you have that, how do you think about splitting your team's effort and also your focus on driving adoption of the open source and also driving adoption of the paid product? And I know like both are important, but how do you kind of manage those priorities?
So some of it happens naturally. And I'll explain why, because the people who work on our what we call in-cluster components these are the main open source things. So those developers, they have the different mindset and they are by nature more of like GitHub people, you know, they're more interactive. So we get more and more focus there. Even if it's not a complete team, it happens a little bit automatically, I would say, the structure. But, you know, one of the things that I've decided to do, and I think one of, you know, we talked about making important decisions, was to invest in an open source. And we brought in a VP of open source, a VP of open source and community, to actually focus on that and make sure that we don't lose, you know, we don't take our eyes out of the ball in that section of the open source. And, you know, I can only, you know, say great things about the guy is Craig Box. He was the dev advocate of Istio. He took Istio to CNCF. And, you know, the level of knowledge he has in open source and development and practices is kind of like way, way, way past mine. And it's great to have him. So that's how we kind of like make sure to keep track and build that in the right way.
Yeah, I think that balance and that team structure has been definitely a lot of people struggle with that. And
so, well, we don't have everything solved yet, you know?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you put someone like, you know, the title VP open source, it has a weight on it, right? Like you need to live up to that. So that's why, you know, we're able to keep that tenacity and keep, you know, going forward and pushing that.
And I'm curious, since your project took off pretty quickly in the early days, I'm asking more like a team structure, right?
Yeah.
How did you actually even structure open source team? Did you have a dev rel early or a community manager kind of help around this at all? Or just is just all your engineers doing that? I know that many teams have different ways and how they structure the responsibility, like who writes content, right? What kind of content? I wonder, how did that change over time for you, even on the open source effort front?
Yeah. Well, I will say that until this day, I'm not sure we have it figured out completely. It's something that keeps evolving as the company and the project evolves. At the beginning, it was my engineers, right? It was the people who wrote CubeScape. They were passionate about it. They were spending their time, you know, on Discord and GitHub, and they were really, really pushing it. Till this day, I think our engineers are the best ambassadors, you know, for our project. But also we have other maintainers today that are also talking about CubeScape. So that's one part. And I think that is still, I would say, the biggest and major, you know, part of that. On top of that, as the company grows, we also put money behind it, right? So we go to conferences and we apply to conferences and we do webinars. And, you know, we have happy users. You know, last month, you know, my CTO had the co-speaking, you know, session about how you use CubeScape to prioritize vulnerabilities with Intel, who are using the product and are using the open source. So those are the type of things. You know, Rabobank went on and in a conference in the Netherlands and talked about, you know, not in the Netherlands, I'm sorry. Yeah, in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and talk about how CubeScape is part of their stack. So the bigger you are, you get more and more users. And in my mind, and again, we're not completely there yet, but the less we talk about CubeScape and our users talk about CubeScape, that's better. And we're getting there. We're getting more and more engagement. And I think that's the way to go.
So I'm wondering what your journey has been as far as figuring out the right way to talk about CubeScape and the positioning, because a lot of the messaging is really focused on just like the speed of implementation. And like, that's a value prop that really speaks to developers. But like, what's kind of the journey been on like talking about the value and kind of like, we talked about it when we first started the call, like the one-liner of like, what are the different attributes that you're like, okay, I want us to be known for these like one, two, maybe three things. And like, what's been your journey of figuring that out?
So it all starts with the user. The journey has been all about, you know, again, if you think about the one thing that kind of like underlines the strategy of the company and making good decisions is to really keep your eyes on the user that you want to delight. And that user for us is the DevOps and the DevSecOps. So, you know, they look at security, for example, as a burden in many times. It's not that they don't like security and don't care about security. I talked about that misconception, but they think about security in a different way. So they want to be secure, but they're engineers. They don't want to do, you know, policy checks. And sometimes I say, I hope I don't get myself in trouble, that DevOps, it's not that they don't like security. They don't like security people. Okay. But, you know, they want to do security on their own and they feel good about it. So we wanted to put up messaging that will actually explain that that's what we want to do. We want to give you security your way. And your way is probably what it is. It is quicker. It is embedded in your own tools. It is in your processes. It is where you live. It is in Slack. It is in, you know, backstage. It's in Prometheus. That's kind of like the way we work about it. And I think that's what kind of like led us to the line and the messaging. The one thing that, very honestly, is not completely a DevOps type message, but it is just something that we understood that we are building that is not out there, is the term platform, right? DevOps, you know, they don't love platforms. It's not a word that speaks to them. But we understood that part of what we bring to the table and the big part of it is that we put a lot of things in a very nice way under one umbrella. And the word we figured out for that was platform. And I think that's how that came about.
Awesome. So definitely, you already shared a bunch of learnings. You already talked to founders in our podcast, I think, but maybe we'll just kind of capitalize on even more. Especially, you went through this sort of pivot, open source, and now, you know, taking off journey. What will be your number one or even two largest advices you give somebody that also wants to start an open source based company right now? Technical background. And maybe even caveat, like security spaces actually have a lot of interest we've seen so far doing this too. So I think that actually has been a very hard to navigate space for a lot of folks as well. So just what would be your number one or two advice that you're going to give them earlier in your journey?
So the first one would be to follow intuition, not in all cases, but when it comes to whether you are succeeding or not. Like if something works, you can feel traction. Okay, like, you'll know it when you get it. And if you don't feel traction, you don't have it. Okay, don't convince yourself. If you don't feel traction, if users are not reacting to you, they're not coming to you, like, don't give yourself excuses. If you don't feel it, you don't have it. So that's one thing that I would put out there. And the second thing, you know, I don't want to sound like a cliche, like listen to the users. Everybody will tell you, listen to the users, right? Okay, I'll give you something. Don't be religious or don't be, religious is not the right word, but don't be fanatic about anything. You know, nothing is black or white. And I'll give you an example for us, PLG, okay? Everybody talks about what is PLG, PLG, PLG. PLG needs to be self-service. You don't talk to customers. Everything happens, you know, on its own. It's not. Nothing is black or white. So don't take excuses like, yeah, I'm a PLG, the product needs to explain itself, and then you don't speak with the customers. No, like PLG is about the product being central in your sale process. But it's not the same for every company. And don't look at benchmarks. You know, it's not, one day I'm going to write a blog about, you know, the activation metric as an example. You know, everybody talks in PLG about, you know, the rate of activation. And I think, you know, you don't know. You can't use benchmarks for that because the way you define activation will define your conversion rate. You know, they say Zoom has an activation rate of, let's say, 15%. When you look at the definition, the activation metric for them is someone who completed, I think, 4 meetings in the first 2 weeks or something like that. They could easily say 8 meetings and have a conversion rate of 5%, right? It's so specific to a company, you know, so don't stick to that. And that's all I'm trying to say there.
That's a really awesome piece of advice to end on. Thank you so much for doing this with us. There are so many helpful nuggets in here. This was awesome.
Thank you. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you for hosting me.